think Tevez going to Juventus, what a coup that was for me. I mean,
on a head-to-head battle, Atletico Madrid can do more damage to Barcelona than the other way around.
Either he's really blind, or he's fixing the match. I can't see it any other way.
I'm trying to get Sir Bob on my side here by saying City will win the Premier League.
It is an upset. You would expect Man United to go and win there.
Over $1 billion was paid in transfer fees between the clubs in Europe.
It's football. It's damn football. Like Ferguson said, football. Bloody marvellous.
Yeah, well, the celebration was, I can't believe I just scored against Mexico.
At one point, Parma, I think it's only like 224 players under contract.
So they're going to throw me out of here, fellas. You're going to get me arrested on your show.
If you're a serious talent, you're going back and you're playing for Santos. You know, you're going back to play for, like in Argentina, for River Plate or Boca Juniors. Or you're going to Europe.
He looked like the Ryan Giggs of old. He was more creative than any player on the pitch. He made Mata look stupid. He made Rooney look silly.
Now, the Premier League is the most exciting league out there. I think it's probably the best marketed league without a question.
When you look at the draw for the Champions League, you kind of say, well, all the pieces kind of fell into place for everybody except City.
I am your host, Joe Uccello.
Sir Bob, Mike Orr.
My co-host, Rob Rojas. My trusted co-host, Ben the Machine.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to episode 227 of Low Limit Football on this 3rd of December 2018 on the Beyond the Pitch Media Network. I'm your host, Joe Uccello, and tonight, PSG is the last perfect team to fall after a 2-2 draw versus Bordeaux in Ligue 1. Tyler Adams of New York Red Bull and MLS fame has completed his transfer from New York Red Bull to RB Leipzig to be reunited with his head coach, Jesse March. Luka Modric wins the 2018 Ballon d'Or, breaking a 10-year streak of wins for both Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo. Norway and Lyon's Ida Hegerberg wins the inaugural Women's Ballon d'Or and is promptly insulted by Martin Solvig. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. Max Allegri and Kylian Mbappe bring home Coach of the Year and Best Young Player, respectively. UEFA Champions League will have VAR in place for the knockout stages of this competition here in 2018-2019. Now we are just waiting on the Premier League and the FIFA Women's World Cup to do the same. And we're going to discuss these things and much, much more with the State of Play podcast host and contributor to Football Italia, Mr. Matthew Santangelo, will be joining us in just a few minutes. But let me get my co-host in here, Mr. Roberto Rojas. Man, how was your week?
It was crazy. It's been crazy with so many news, especially some news coming out of Argentina of a game that I think will never be played. But I think for the moment, as if we've gotten at this moment, December 3rd, 2018 at 7:03 p.m., we do have a Super Classico and we will have a location, but it's not the location we all expected.
It's a different continent. We're going to talk about that a little later on. And you notice in the show plan, I put in there that the match will be played, the second leg will be played, and I wrote maybe LOL exclamation point. Because right now, you just don't know.
Like I said, Joe, why don't you use your backyard?
Dude, I'm good. Listen, the story of I've lived in this house just over 14 years. It was 14 years in November. And when my wife and I, we'd been searching for houses for months, and we couldn't find anything that was just exactly what we wanted. You know, it was too much of this, too little of that, too here, too there. And when we pulled into this street and pulled into the driveway of this house, I said to myself, I actually said to the realtor, I don't need to see the inside. I want to buy the house because my front yard, Robin, you've been here. It's so flat and so wide open. All I could picture is myself playing soccer with my kids in my front yard. My front yard is almost big enough to hold a full size pitch. I mean, it's close. I have to take a little bit of the neighbor's yard, but we could get pretty close to having a decent sized pitch on my front yard. And that's how I saw it. So if they want to have the Copa Libertadores in Connecticut, I'm all in, man. I can take care of the permits. I can get the hosts here. I don't know what I can do about the Barra Bravas, and I don't know what I can do about the security.
Nah, you'll be fine.
Well, you think? I don't know. The way they're talking right now, these guys are traveling These guys are traveling with fire in their eyes. We'll see what happens and if it actually goes off this weekend. But we're going to talk about that a little later on, man. Let's do something first. Let's get our Onnit promo in here so that we can help pay the bills. So from Onnit.
Onnit is a health and fitness juggernaut dedicated to delivering total human optimization to its vast customer base of athletes, thinkers, fitness gurus, and entrepreneurs. Through a wide array of products and supplements, Onnit combines cutting-edge science, earth-grown nutrients, and time-tested strategies to help people reach peak performance. Whether you're climbing mountains or biking down them, building businesses or closing sales, chasing PRs in the weight room or running a marathon, Onnit is the brand you want in your back pocket. As one of the fastest-growing health and fitness companies in the world, Onnit refuses to bring anything but the very best to market. Whether it be energy bars, protein shakes, creatine, or their flagship product, Alpha Brain, Onnit's diverse lineup of products and supplements are backed by science and research. You can save up to 10% off by visiting Onnit.com and using the coupon code BEYOND.
Thanks to the people over at Onnit. Rob, let's move along here quickly. Let's get some trivia going on here. It is your honor. So what do you got for me tonight?
Yes, I do. So we're going to talk about the Ballon d'Or just a bit. Yep. We do want to congratulate Luka Modric for being the first player since Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo to win the Ballon d'Or, first time in 11 years now. Yep, Kaká was the last one. So with that being mine, Messi, for some reason, and I think you have to agree with me, Joe, when I have to say this, Messi has finished in his lowest position in a Ballon d'Or shortlist. He finished fifth in the Ballon d'Or for the first time since 2007 when he was 20 years old. What was his ranking that year?
That year, I've got that.
And, a two-part, he was also included in his first Ballon d'Or shortlist in 2006, at the age of 19, what position did he finish? So I'm asking you basically, what positions did he finish the years that he didn't go into the top three?
Other than first and second, where has he finished? I think the other one, so at 20 years old, I know is this one. And at 19, I want to say he was, I'm just writing this down.
Yep.
Okay. Good trivia question. I was thinking you're going to ask me who was the last person to win, not named Messi or Ronaldo. And I'm like,
that one's too easy.
Kaká's too easy. But all right, let's jump across the pond, Rob, and let's get into tonight's opening thoughts. And I guess tonight's show really feels like a bunch of rerun stories for you and me, Rob. I think. It's things we've talked about a bit, but things that have developed. And this is one of them. This is the big one. The United States, after almost over 400 days, have finally hired a head coach. And I wish I had a sound effect for this, like applause or something. And the head coach is none other than Greg Berhalter, somebody that we've been talking about now for a few weeks. There is a press conference scheduled for tomorrow at noon with U.S. Soccer President Carlos Cordero, Secretary General Dan Flynn, Greg Berhalter himself, Ernie Stewart as well, and that'll be streamed on ussoccer.com to introduce Greg Berhalter as the new U.S. men's soccer coach, replacing Dave Sarakin as the interim head coach, replacing Bruce Arena as the last head coach of this team after the team lost in Trinidad and Tobago and not qualified for the 2018 World Cup. So we've talked about this ad nauseum a little bit, Rob. One thing that I pointed out, I want to say it was either last week or the week before, is that the issue here for Greg Berhalter now is that the challenge is enormous in terms of the perceived shoes he's going to have to fill, because there's an expectation when you wait 400 days to hire a head coach, you think you're hiring Jesus Christ himself. And for me, I think that those are going to be the shoes. Now, granted, what does he have to do? You would say in the very immediate future, you would expect him to at least win the Gold Cup in 2019 or get to the final against what would most likely be Mexico or Costa Rica, but at least either play in the final or win the championship. Those, I think, are the absolute short-term minimum requirements for Greg Berhalter. As we move forward, what are they going to be the other ones? I believe, Rob, correct me if I'm wrong, they were not invited to the Copa America.
Nope.
Okay, so that's not going to be on the table for them. The next thing is going to be qualify for the World Cup in 2022.
You're missing one. You're missing one important one.
I knew I was missing one, and it's just escaping my brain right now.
The Olympics.
Okay. Yeah, but Berhalter's not going to be the coach for the Olympics. Won't it be Tab Ramos for that?
It depends on the team that they bring. But I think they still need. I still think that's something that Greg Berhalter needs to focus on as well.
Okay,
is to help that team qualify for the Olympics.
Sure,
because they haven't been one in a long time.
Absolutely. So, and I would put that more on the head of Ernie Stewart than I would Greg Berhalter. I would put it on those guys instead. Now, one thing I want to bring up here, Rob, and you know, I want to ask your opinion about this. There's the talk of nepotism here, that this was a nepotism hiring because Jay Berhalter is in the upper ranks with U.S. soccer. I believe Jay Berhalter hired Ernie Stewart in this position. And the common thought is that Dan Flynn will be stepping down, I believe, next year, and Jay Berhalter may be taking over for him. So I'd like your thoughts on the conspiracy theory that there was nepotism involved in the hiring of Greg Berhalter as the U.S. men's head coach.
I mean, 14 months too late. That's the first thing I could say. Yeah. No, I mean, look, this has been something that has been going on. We've been talking this ad nauseum for 14 straight months. It's been tiring, but thankfully it's all done and dusted. But, you know, the one thing I will have to say, and I think Phil Shane said this on his Twitter, I think shortly after the announcement was made, that they could do better. The United States could do better. The fact that I think you feel as if though we feel a feeling of apathy in this sense. Maybe he'll be fantastic, and I wish the best for him. But I just still can't see how a year-long worldwide search came up with an average coach on an average team in an average league as the best choice for the top job in the nation. That's all I could say, because that's something that, yes, you understand, it is the United States. It's not other big national teams. It's not Brazil. It's not Germany. It's not France. It's not any of those big countries who are up at the upper echelon of world football. Mm-hmm. It's the United States. But, you know, you would think that it would attract some people in terms of the challenge that comes into their place. You know, a team that has not qualified for the World Cup. It was the first time in 28 years that they haven't done it. 30 years, sorry. So, you know, you look at that, and then you look at the options that clearly were right in front of U.S. soccer's eyes, be it Ernie Stewart or Carlos Cordero, right there in our own, not even in our own country, in our own continent. I mean, and to think that we passed on other managers who have gone to better things and will eventually go on to better things because of stupid, and I'm going to say this as nice as I could be, because of stupid reasons that the coach needs to connect to the fans and not the fans, and the players and get that patriotism and whatnot, is the idea that, you know, the manager needs to speak English, mm-hmm. which, correct me if I'm wrong, Joe, I mean, certainly the United States, with all the money that it has, and I'm sure U.S. soccer has a ton of it in the bank, could hire a translator to help this team, but they passed on they passed on coaches like Juan Carlos Osorio, who went to Paraguay, Tata Martino, right here. Easily the best coach, I think, perhaps, in the country right now. Mm-hmm. He's going to Mexico, most likely. You look at another one, the guy that went to Oscar Pareja.
Oscar Pareja.
You know, you looked at him. You look at other managers. Julian Lopetegui clearly was something that the United States, that was on that radar. And they said, no, we're good. We don't need him. So, I mean, we can't really say anything else until we see what he does. We don't know. What we will see from this team, we're going to have to wait until I think the first friendly is in February against Costa Rica. Mm-hmm. Then we're going to see what happens there, and that's all we can do. But from a long-term perspective, and I understand Berhalter has had a great success at Columbus, you know, did well there. But as I can mention what Phil Shane has said, I still can't believe that a year-long worldwide search came up with an average coach on an average team in an average league as the best choice for the top job in the nation to be the head coach of the United States national team.
Phil Shane said it perfectly today on SiriusXM as well. He said, you know, there was this whole thing about that the coach has to speak English. You don't need a coach that speaks English. You need a coach that speaks football. And then you teach the player Spanish. That's what you do. And we need a coach that speaks football. Now, does Greg Berhalter speak football? I mean, to an extent, you've got to think he does, right? I mean, this is not somebody that just was the coach of the Columbus Crew, you know, for a couple of years and then that was it. He's won MLS Cup with the LA Galaxy. He's coached, he's actually coached in Hammerby, which I believe is over in Sweden. He's played at Zwolle. He's played at Crystal Palace. He's played at 1860 Munich. He did scouting for 1860 Munich as well. So he's got a pedigree, an international pedigree. Okay, to an extent. I just think that when you go 400 days, the hire's got to be flashy. I mean, you could have had Greg Berhalter in January. And he probably wouldn't have this angst against Greg Berhalter if you hired him in January. You probably don't know. See, now one of the other things is that what US Soccer managed to do was they managed to use Dave Sarakin as a pawn to do the rough work, to do the, oh, we're going to play the kids, which everybody wanted. And I know a lot of us are disappointed with the way the team has been playing over the past, I'd say, 6 months, but the team has had no direction. So if you put Greg Berhalter in that spot in January and say, play the kids, and he played the kids, but there was a direction, then I think we might think differently about this.
Yep.
But when we just sit there and wait 400 days, let somebody do the dirty work without direction. It's a year that some people are saying the year is not thrown away. No, the year is thrown away because you want to develop these kids and you want to move these kids along in the system that you want them to play. And now we are starting 2019 where we should have started 2018. And that's the time lost. So are these kids and their kids, don't get me wrong. I mean, we're not talking about Michael Bradley and Josie Altidore and Clint Dempsey. Those days are gone. Jermaine Jones, those days are gone. And, yep. And the days of Zach Steffen are here and the days of Tyler Adams are here and Christian Pulisic and Weston McKennie. Those are the days that are here now. And have those kids lost a year? That's my worry is that Greg Berhalter in June is 2019 is doing things that should have been done in June of 2018.
But let me ask you this, Joe: what could you have done in a World Cup year where you don't qualify?
Well, I think
you have to do is play these friendlies.
Sure,
good question. I think the kids need the experience,
of course. But look at the friendlies they scheduled. They had Portugal, right? They had France. They had the Netherlands. No, I'm sorry, they didn't have the Netherlands. They had Germany. They had England, right?
No, Italy and England.
I
have an order. Bosnia, Herzegovina, Paraguay, Bolivia, Ireland, France, Brazil, Mexico, Colombia, Peru, England, Italy.
I mean, look at those squads. Wouldn't you have liked to have installed your system by the time you hit that last friendly against Italy?
100%.
Yeah, and at least have a look at it so that when you go into the January camp, you can kind of pick and choose those players where you can get them, kind of fine-tune what you can, and then really go into the Gold Cup on the front foot. Now he's gonna have to go look at that film of kids that are running around a field that have no direction. Figure out what he wants to do with them, and then install that. But the minute he installs that, you've got Costa Rica on the door. You've got Mexico on the door. You've got a Gold Cup that I know we don't put a lot of value into the Gold Cup here as fans, as opposed to, let's say, the Copa America or the Euros.
Well, no, absolutely, because it serves as a qualification for the Confederations Cup.
No, I know that, but I think the general soccer fan in the United States does not put the value into that tournament that a South American fan would put into Argentina winning the Copa America. Do you know what I mean? Or Spain winning the Euros. I just think that the region is watered down. Let's talk about that. You know, you got Costa Rica, you got Mexico, you got the United States, and then you're done, right? So whereas if we take that and we look at South America, we've got Brazil, we got Argentina, we got Chile, we got Uruguay, we got Colombia, you know, we got Paraguay, we got Ecuador. There's a lot of talent there. You go to Europe. We don't have enough time to list all the teams. So I think the perceived value of the tournament is less than those other ones because of the caliber and quality of teams that are playing in it. And having said that, this becomes even more important because if you underperform at a tournament where you feel that the talent is underwhelming, then you are really in a bad spot moving forward trying to qualify for the World Cup, in my opinion. And I think that Greg Berhalter needed a win. U.S. soccer needs a win. Do you know what I mean? And I think that Gold Cup would be a win if we had our pieces in place. But we dragged our heels putting our pieces in place, so it's going to have to be done very, very quickly. And is Greg Berhalter the right guy to do that? Those are going to be the questions we are going to answer going into June, or we're going to hope to answer going into the June tournament. So, you know what? Let's jump into one of our topics, Rob. I'll tell you what. Let's do Copa Libertadores quickly. And I'm going to throw it over to you as I message Matt, because like you had alluded to in the beginning, we've got the game moved, and I'd like your thoughts on it, because this is something that is going to become a big deal, I think, for other competitions, right?
Yeah, no, this is something that, unfortunately, our worst fear was going to happen. You know, there has been talk about having a tournament like the Copa, like the, even then, you know, you look at the Copa America being played in the United States, you know, you look at the La Liga coming here to play here in the United States, and now you have the inevitable. And perhaps probably the most ironic of ironies that we've ever seen in the Copa Libertadores. The first is the fact that we will have a final. We played on December 9th between Boca and River. Mm-hmm. But the one thing, it will not be in Argentina. It will not be in South America. It won't even be in any of the Americas, Joe, even though there was some of the rumors. It will be played at the Santiago Bernabeu in Madrid, Spain.
Now, the thinking behind that, obviously, is to move it off continent for safety's sake, that sort of thing. Do you think that was done as partially a punishment to River?
No.
Okay.
No, I think they were just doing it because they realized that they needed to get safety, and the only way to do that is, hey, let's play it in probably one of the safest non-Latin America, well, it is technically Latin America, actually, going back to it, but non-South American and North American country there is. And do it in Spain, which, you know, is ironic. I mean, Joe, come on. A Copa Libertadores, you know, the heroes of independence. It's as if you're playing that tournament, which in theory is in memory of the heroes of independence of South America some 200 years ago, are going to be playing it in the country that, you know, and this was kind of the joke that came in. The Copa Conquistadores is now the new name of the tournament.
Right. The country that conquered them. Exactly.
Yep.
Which is a crazy idea, but it boggles the mind. You know, and we talked about this last week with Austin Miller that, you know, I thought that for sure we were going, and I'm just trying to get something punched in here. I thought for sure it was just going to be a heavy fine. Now, that fine they got was like $350,000, I think, American.
Yep.
Is that right, Rob?
Yep. That's right.
Yeah. So, I mean, I expected it to be a little heavier than that. But then, obviously, talking to people like Juan Arango, who said that, you know, given the situation with the financial situation of Argentina, the number is actually a pretty big number for them to eat. So I guess the number is okay, but just absolutely crazy to think that, you know. Yeah. So let's talk about what happened in England on the weekend, Rob, because obviously we had some huge matches. Really, you know, it was Derby Day in England on Sunday, starting out with the West London Derby between Chelsea and Fulham. Moving on to the North London Derby, which was obviously Arsenal Tottenham, which we had featured on our match of the week, and then closing in the Merseyside Derby between Liverpool and Everton. It's just a crazy day of football. Chelsea, I think, you know, did fairly well. Rob, I'm gonna take your suggestion. I'm gonna sign you off and then sign you back on here. You know, with Chelsea football, I think that was a pretty, you know, entertaining matchup. Obviously, 2-0 to Chelsea, winning that one, and then from there we moved on to the North London Derby, which was certainly highly entertaining. I've got Rob, I've got you back on now.
Yes, you do.
Okay, I'm gonna try to add Matt on now. But in the meantime, I want your thoughts on the North London Derby on the weekend, because really it was a Unai Emery masterclass, right? I mean, he made the right changes at halftime. He pushed the right buttons, and it led to a huge second half for Arsenal. Phil Shane, again, listening on SiriusXM this morning, said that if you took the first half of every match of the season and ranked the teams by that metric, you would have Arsenal finishing somewhere around 18th place. So they would be relegated. But because of their second half heroics that they've turned in time and time again, they're in a Champions League spot. So what were your thoughts on the North London Derby?
I thought it was a game that Arsenal needed to win. I feel as if, though, they really needed to get that momentum in, especially under a new coach, especially the fact that, you know, this North London Derby has been citing more the Spurs in recent times, that they needed this win. And hard to believe, Joe, you know, this is actually the first Spurs, you know, they played 14 games. They've won 10. They've only lost 4. They've never drawn a single game. They're the only team in all of the Premier League to have not drawn a single game. So, you know, it's either a win or a loss when it comes to this team. But in terms of Arsenal, I mean, you know, they're still – I think this win was essential given the fact that when you look at the gap from 5th and 6th, it's 8 points. Spurs in 5th place with 30 points, but in 6th is 22 points. So there's an 8-point gap between both these teams. And I think Arsenal needed that win. And they needed that win to get that momentum and to start battling it out for those tight spots in the Premier League. Mm-hmm. Because surely, you know, it's still going on. We still have two teams that have not lost a single game yet, in Manchester City and Liverpool, who, you know, got it late on against Everton. Then you have Chelsea creeping up. So I think this is a well-deserved win. A great game, I think, from Lucas Torreira, you know, who was able to come in, be that kind of, you know, player that we expect, and I'm sure Matt is going to be super happy given the big fan that he is after the work that we've seen him at Sampdoria. You know, he's been doing phenomenal at Arsenal so far. You know, one of the key pieces, one of the great players on this team. And for me, I think this was a win that Arsenal really needed to get and certainly, you know, bring back that momentum in for this Premier League race.
No doubt about it. Lucas Torreira scoring his first Premier League goal today. Huge, you know, victory for Arsenal moving forward. Liverpool kind of skin of their teeth, Rob. 93rd minute, Divock Origi on a little bit of a mistake in the match.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I can't think of his name now. Isn't it Jordan Pickford?
Jordan Pickford.
Yeah,
yep.
So, you know, a little bit of a mistake there in the stoppage time, which gave Liverpool that victory, or else they were a 0-0 draw in that one. I'm going to try to get Matt in here again. But it was definitely a great day, you know, derby day-wise in England in the EPL. So
hello,
hi, and I have you now, Matt.
Yeah, I think you guys got me.
Awesome, man. How are you tonight?
Pretty well, especially the technical difficulties. I think on my end, I'm not too sure. I'm doing pretty well. What about you guys?
Good. Yeah, no, we're doing great, man. And who knows, man? Skype is a crazy thing sometimes, and very unreliable at times. But I'm glad you're here again. You know, joining us, Matt Santangelo from Football Italia, State of Play Pod. You know, you're Tony Miola's go-to name drop, by the way, on Sirius XM for all things Serie A. I don't know if you know that. So that's a pretty high honor, in my opinion, to be that. And definitely always a great friend of this show. I want to open up with a quick question about AC Milan. I know how much you love them. And I want to talk about Gennaro Gattuso, because within the past 3 to 4 weeks, there was talk of AC Milan moving Gattuso on, sacking him, bringing in somebody else that can further the project, you know, now that it's going in the right direction, thanks to Gattuso and thanks to a little bit of coaching stability at the San Siro. But Gattuso's turned around and he's got them all but qualified into the knockout stages of the Europa League. You know, and it ended up being a tough group with Real Betis and Olympiacos. They only really need a draw on the last match day to qualify through. And he's got them in Champions League spots right now in the Serie A, which is really a tough battle, because when you look at the teams that are surrounding them, you've got Juve off to this incredible start. Napoli is definitely playing very well, even though they're playing on all fronts. They've added Carlo Ancelotti, and even though they've lost Jorginho, they haven't missed a step. Inter is just playing out of their minds lately, although on the weekend, I think they'll consider themselves unlucky to end up with that 2-2 draw against Roma. But AC Milan now is in fourth place, ahead of Lazio, ahead of Torino, ahead of Roma, and in my opinion, playing pretty well. So is Gattuso's job safe, or is this something that they're going to move him along anyway and bring in somebody else?
Well, first off, thanks for having me back on, guys. I appreciate talking to you guys again about the thing I love most, Calcio, of course. But getting to Gattuso, I think it's, again, you touched on it and you covered quite a bit of what Gattuso's situation was at Milan, right? It feels like it was a week-to-week situation. There was a point in time this season where dropping points to teams that they should have beaten, of course, with all the non-clean sheets they were picking up and going through that spell as well. And then you pile on the injuries. It looked like as though Gattuso was going to be out sooner rather than later. Of course, we even had that rumor that Arsene Wenger was going to come in, which I never believed for a minute. And of course, that has died down. And then obviously, you can probably attribute a lot of it to Gattuso, you know, kind of turning things around and obviously steadying the ship so far. Again, of course, they have quite a bit of work to do to get to the end of the year, which I think has kind of been the biggest checkpoint, if you will, for me and for Milan. And what I mean by that is we're going to start to get some guys back. I think you'll start to get Romagnoli back. Some of these guys, like Conti, will be ready to play. And you'll start to see, again, of course, Bonaventura and some of these other guys are going to be out for pretty much the entire season and more. But I think more or less you're going to start to get some big key guys back in the defense in certain areas that should only help Nylund further continue to compete for top four. And then when you throw in the fact when they have the January transfer window, obviously you can expect them to be a little bit more active this time around. Of course, Lucas Paqueta from Flamengo looks like he's going to be coming in ready to train. I believe he's going to have his medical on Sunday, so he'll be in the thick of things. Of course, we've heard Ibrahimovic, Cesc Fabregas to play in the midfields, which has been riddled with injuries, let's be real here, of course, in many other areas as well. But that midfield really needs some help. And I think, again, of course, you can expect Milan to be busy this winter. But yeah, everything you talked about with some of the other teams around Milan, I think is fascinating because, for a team like Inter, for instance, who have had a tremendous first half of the season so far, I mean, they're in a really good spot right now, don't get me wrong, in third place. But when you really look at it, Milan haven't even come close to playing their best football yet, where you think as Inter, how much better can Inter really get with their results and their performances? So it makes you wonder where a healthy Milan can possibly be and end up this season.
You know, Matt, I'm going to jump in because certainly it's been an interesting race so far between, all the top teams in Serie A. You know, you have Juventus, even though they do have an 8-point gap, you look at the team still creeping up. And so far, we're almost halfway down with the season, and it's been quite interesting. You know, the fact that even beforehand we thought that Juventus, would have this great team and then have dominated, and rightly so. 13 wins, only one draw, and they've done exceptionally well. But you look at teams like Joe had mentioned, Napoli creeping in with their great football under Kyle Ancelotti. You look at Inter playing well with Spalletti. You look at Milan, of course, with Gattuso. You look at other teams as well creeping in. What have you been your impressions so far of this season? Given the fact that, it's been perhaps a bit closed off, I guess, for the other teams, given the dominance of Juventus so far this season. But, I just want your thoughts on how this season has panned out. And, I think, do you expect some of the same for Juventus and the other teams? Or do you feel that we're indeed in good shape for a race come the new year, I would say?
I think most of what I'm seeing with the table right now is pretty much what I expected. I expected actually Napoli to be a little bit closer to Juve, to be honest with you. I just think, again, right now, I think the gap is, 9 points, give or take?
8 points.
Eight points. Excuse me. So, I mean, if you really look at what the table is, I mean, last year, Napoli were with Juventus until pretty much the last month and change of the season before they kind of fell off, and eventually Juventus claimed another title. But I think, again, generally speaking, you got to like what Napoli's done in the league. I think in second place, I think without question, I think they were expected to be in this point, in this position, excuse me, and finish here. But I think you really have to look at what Napoli has been able to accomplish in the Champions League, which it speaks volumes right now. I think they're well positioned to move on to the round of 16, which they didn't do last year under Sarri. And they could possibly even top their group. And really, if you look at the grand scheme of things for all Serie A clubs, in the Champions League, we could have four teams in the round of 16, which is exactly what you want as a Calcio fan. So I think, again, maybe the biggest thing or the weirdest thing or thing I didn't expect in this season was seeing Lazio and seeing Roma kind of struggle the way they have. I think I expected Napoli, Juve, and Inter to be right there, top three. And then, of course, Milan competing fourth, fifth, sixth, give or take until the very end, because I knew how competitive it was last year. But I'm kind of stunned to see how Roma and Lazio, the teams from Rome, kind of slip and really not show their best so far. I'm not saying they can't turn it around because it's a long season. By no means have Milan claimed fourth or they have shown that they are the legitimate team to finish in that fourth spot. But I think it's just kind of strange to see how they've kind of struggled. And even with a team like Fiorentina, who got a lot of praise coming into the season with all the young talent with Piazza, Chiesa, Simeone, and then all of a sudden, you look at the table and they're really not where they probably want to be or where we expected them to be. So I think, again, you touched on it. We're 14 games in. We're about halfway through the season. This is where you really start to see the table take shape. But of course, the beauty about Calcio, and we saw it on the final match day last year, and in previous years with the relegation battle and the race for top four, it's week to week, things change. And in a month, you can see this complete reversed. I mean, the table, you can see teams like Lazio, Roma right in the thick of things once again. So I think the second half of the season is going to be very special.
And definitely, you know, going into the Calcio teams, and especially in the Champions League, they are really in pole position to have all their four teams qualify mm-hmm. to the round of 16. You know, you look at Inter Milan, who are in that tough group with Spurs, Barcelona, and PSV, but do need a win against PSV. And I hope that Barcelona do a favor and get a some sort of result against them to see them qualify with Barcelona to the round of 16. You look at Napoli in that really tight race between PSG, Liverpool, and Red Star Belgrade to advance to the knockout stage. You look at Roma, already qualified with Real Madrid, and you look at Juventus as well, who, you know, are expected to qualify. You know, they haven't lost they only lost one game in that group, but, you know, have done exceptionally well. How have you assessed the performances from the Serie A team so far in the Champions League?
Well, I think it's been very good. I think, again, we've expected Juventus to be where they are. Obviously, that slip up against Manchester United, I think, was a one-off. I think you won't see Allegri have that type of slip up again, or Juventus have that slip up again. But in any case, they're in the round of 16 with Roma. Inter and Napoli still have some work to do. But it wouldn't surprise me. I think, again, if you really look at the entirety and the grand scheme of things with Inter and Napoli, because obviously the other two teams that are into the round of 16, Napoli and Inter have played really good football, and all things considered, in the Champions League. I think, again, you touched on it with the groups. I think they, you know, PSG and Liverpool in one group. And then, of course, you have Red Star Belgrade playing really well, getting that victory over Liverpool. So it's really making it even that much tougher for a team like Napoli, to get that round of 16 berth, which I think they're well positioned. And I think, you know, having Ancelotti, that experience and that pedigree in this tournament with three Champions League trophies to his name, I think that should really help them get over the edge and really push themselves into the round of 16. And we saw what happened with Roma last year. You get to the round of the 16, you get a lucky draw or a favorable draw. Yeah, all of a sudden you position yourself and maybe you make a really deep run. And I think that's what Napoli fans want to see from Napoli. If they can't win the title, which again, barring a major collapse from Juventus, I think they really love to see a Napoli team make a deep run and show that they are for real. They are a legitimate European squad beyond all of the Sarrismo that we've talked about in previous years, how great that is, how easy on the eyes is. But getting that next step and that next objective checked off, if you will, in that deep run in the Europe in the Champions League, I think is the biggest thing that Napoli fans want right now, and I think it'll really push them into the conversation as a team that's really a force.
Definitely. So let's switch to obviously the big game happening this weekend. No, it's not the Copa Libertadores that perhaps will never be played, assuming that the rumors go by. No, we're actually going to go to Atlanta, as we have Atlanta United take on Portland in the MLS Cup final. Certainly a big game over there in Mercedes-Benz. Atlanta have been playing exceptionally well. You know, I've seen some of your stuff on pods talking about Atlanta and how great they've been so far this season, you know, with the likes of Tata Martino as their coach. You can look at players like Josep Martinez, Miguel Miron, among many other players. Then you look at the Portland Timbers, who are, you know, playing exceptionally well, defeating Sporting KC heading into the final. So, I mean, Matt, quickly, I mean, is this Atlanta City lose? I mean, because certainly, you know, they have been the best team so far in MLS, even though they didn't have the record that the Red Bulls had in the Supporters' Shield. I mean, you have to say that this is Atlanta's title to finally get a title to the city of Atlanta.
Oh, absolutely. I think you could really look. I think last year, again, it was a little bit of a difficult one for them, because I think, again, they had the sensational first year. They got all the attention, you know, filling their stadiums, packing their new stadium as a new franchise, of course, in Major League Soccer. But then they had that pressure and they couldn't replicate that. I believe it was the Columbus Crew who upset them in the playoffs last year. So that kind of, you know, took them by storm and kind of rattled their cages. But yeah, the way I think this year you're really starting to see, despite not having that same type of record, that same type of stature that the Red Bulls have in terms of the results, in terms of the record, and that regard, I think you really look at them and they've looked more mature. I think they kind of took that loss in the playoffs last year, and they're really starting to kind of get over the hump and really show that, okay, like, this is our year to do this. And it's more than just that, though, because if you really look at it, with all the rumors going on with Atlanta United right now, Tata Martino could be being replaced. There are a couple of different names mentioned with him. They're replacing him on the bench for Atlanta United. But then you're also looking at guys like Miguel Almirón, who has been heavily linked to Arsenal and their Premier League teams. So, you know, you got to look at it in that regard, too, is that this is their year, because at some point they may lose a guy like Joseph Martinez, or a guy like Miguel Almiron, a coach, and you don't know when you're going to be back in this situation. So I think they really got to take advantage of it. And I think, again, I really do expect them to do so.
Matt, I'm going to jump in here because I want to turn it to more of an international question here. Because we had the draw this week for the Euros, for the 2020 Euros, the group drawings, and obviously with your ties to Poland, I did want to ask you about Group G and the group that they were drawn into with Austria, Israel, Slovenia, Macedonia, and Latvia. What are your thoughts on this group? Is this something that you feel Poland should easily navigate through and get to the Euros, or do you feel that there's some stumbling blocks here in this group?
Well, it's interesting, too, because I, for one, in a strange way, would have liked a little bit more of a test. And I'm no disrespect to any of the teams in this group, because you can't take any team seriously. And on any given match, any given day, you can be upset and you can be humbled. And I think, again, with Poland, I would have liked a little bit more competition in this group. But the simple fact is that I think you really do need those tests, right? We looked at what they got in their when they topped their group for the World Cup. 16 or 17 goals from Lewandowski set a record for goals in a World Cup qualifying phase. Then they got to the World Cup. They weren't playing nearly as anything close to a 7th or 8th ranked team, which is what they were. And all of a sudden they bounced out in the group stage. Mm-hmm. So for me, with Adam Nawalka, with the current state of Polish football right now and what I saw during this UEFA Nations League games, I'm not too convinced right now that Poland are just going to walk right through this group and qualify for the Euro. I do think, again, they will, but I think it's not going to be so cut and dry, because if you look at them, people would say, well, they're probably the favorite. They're probably, the team that they should handle most of these fixtures and really kind of more or less take care of business. But I think, again, I've seen this too many times, and I think if you ask most Polish fans, and I know a couple that on the ground in Poland, what the overall vibe is and the actual feeling is about this Poland team entering this and really entering big competitions, is that they really don't know what the future holds for the Polish football. Obviously, plenty of talent. We went over it in the World Cup preview episode way back early in the summer. But again, I think there's more to that. We looked at the game against Italy where they were bad, and they were also very bad against Portugal. So not saying that any of the opponents in their group are on that level, but I think, again, you gotta be sure here that you're not just going to look at the team and say, well, they're not a Spain, they're not an Italy, they're not an England, we can go through this. No, because stranger things have happened. I wouldn't be surprised if there's some more upsets in this group. Poland need to come to play, and they're going to obviously rely on Lewandowski, but guys like Zielinski, guys like Milik, Kanowski, those guys need to step up. And I think it's a difficult situation with their defense as well. They're going through a little bit of a transition. Piszczek's gone. Glik is up there in age. No Pazdan. They have Bednarik and a couple of the different names in the back. So I think it's really going to take some time for me to fully assess what Poland is all about and what type of team I can expect to see throughout the Euro qualifying phase. But I think right now it's a little bit too difficult for me to predict. I'm hoping they get through, but obviously we saw with Italy, right? You probably looked at it and saying, oh, they probably should have no problem qualified, and they didn't qualify. So you got to come to play. You can't underestimate any opponent, because they got nothing to lose.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Italy, because in Group J, I think their group, although on paper is quote-unquote easy, a little more difficult than I think the road Poland has to navigate. In Group J, Italy's got Bosnia and Herzegovina, Finland, Greece, Armenia, and Liechtenstein. Obviously, with the new look to them, with Roberto Mancini coming in after that disaster with Ventura, what do you expect from this Italian side in this group? Given that they weren't really scoring goals in that Nations League tournament against Poland and against Portugal, what do you expect out of the Italian side here moving forward?
Well, I'm hoping what I expect and what I hope for are probably two different things here. What I'm expecting is that midfield to continue to develop, to continue to build chemistry. We've seen in the previous international breaks, Jorginho, Marco Verratti, and Nicola Barella, they've really kind of been a cohesive group, and I think Mancini understands that he has found that midfield group. Of course, you could throw in Stefano Sensi, who looked really impressive as well. I think you have some names that you can finally look to and say, yeah, they're not Pirlo, they're not Gattuso, they're not those types of guys, but you can expect them to do a job and expect them to be, an effective midfield trio. And that's exactly what I think most Italy fans are hoping from them. Mm-hmm. Defensively, I think they're going to be fine. Chiellini, Bonucci, tried and true group, the last two remnants of the old guard of BBC. I think they're going to do a good job. I like their fullback plays, although I can, of course, Berardi, I think, can be upgraded. Hoping Conte is healthy, works his way into Milan starting 11, and then eventually maybe can get a look for the national team under Mancini. So that's something to keep an eye on. It's the attack. I think let's address the elephant in the room here. They got to score goals. I think someone brought up his stats. I think it was something called Graziano Pelle. 20 appearances, 9 goals. He's pretty much Italy's best performing striker of the past decade, which, I mean, come on. I'm not trying to disrespect the guy because he scored some pretty good goals and some pretty famous goals in the Euro, but you need someone to produce. Immobile hasn't done it. Belotti's kind of up and down since he's been through these injuries. Balotelli, who knows what his future is with the national team. It's, you know what I'm leaning to here. It's Patrick Cutrone. You got to get a shot here. I'd rather see it sooner rather than later. I would hate for him to be thrown in there into a really important game in the Euro qualifier and then have that stage be too big for him. Again, I do think, unlike many young players, he has the right mentality. I think he's been thrown into a difficult situation at Milan, and he's thrived. But I think, again, Cutrone has got to be given a shot soon by Mancini. And, with the way I've seen Mancini select his players each and every international break, he is willing to give young players an opportunity, which, again, Ventura really didn't do all that much, and either did Conte. So I look forward to seeing Cutrone get minutes, get either a start here and there, and then hopefully cement himself as Italy's number 9 for now and for the future.
Matt, I mean, you also have to mention the kid from Brescia, Sandro Tonali, who has a bright future ahead of him, don't you think?
Well, absolutely. I think, again, me and my partner touched upon this on the State of Play podcast a couple weeks ago. Obviously, Sandro Tonali is getting a lot of traction, a lot of attention. He's got the long hair. He plays the same position as Pirlo. He comes from Brescia just like Pirlo, and all the comparisons are coming in. But I think at the same time, you got to understand that he is 18 years old. And I think you look at that, where the position he plays, it's, you have Jorginho and you have Verratti, who are pretty similar in the sense that they play that deeper role, more as a controller of the midfield type player. So I don't see Sandro Tonali getting a full-fledged opportunity to be a starter, but it wouldn't surprise me to see him get his debut sooner than rather than later. Mm-hmm. Again, of course, I'm touching upon it. Mancini's been giving opportunities to youngsters frequently, really since he took over. So again, Sandro Tonali, at this point, it's important for them to just kind of train with the squad, train with the older players, get a feeling of what it takes to be a Turin player. And I think, again, of course, Sandro Tonali, the biggest thing for him right now is to continue to play well. I think he'll finish the season at Brescia before moving on in the summer. Maybe he'll agree to a move in January for the summer. But I think, again, he has to be playing at a big club.
Matt, Rob, do I still have you?
Yes, you do.
I think we've lost Matt. What I'll do is I'll find a way to message him. But interesting that, with the 18-year-old Sandro Tonali, it is a full midfield for him to break into. But I've got to say, I'm wondering about the longevity of Marco Verratti if he does get challenged. And that's
because I think that's what needs to happen at this point. Look, they have a stacked midfield, but if you're going on form and not playing well for your club and country, then you have to bring in one that's feeling hot.
Exactly. So, I you talked. He pointed out how Mancini's been bringing in the youth and playing some of that youth. Nicola Barella is one of those kids that really kind of gelled the midfield. And I think Barella's only 23, if I remember right.
21.
21. Yeah, even younger. So, it's been a great revelation. But again, they've got to find the goals. They're not getting them from Ciro Immobile. Maybe Cutrone, like he had mentioned, gets a chance where he can, at least get in there. And I'm just going to message Matt quick. I
I wanted to get a plug in for him, but I'm going to mention his you know, State of Play podcast. Look him up on Twitter, and obviously at Matt Santangelo on Twitter as well. He's definitely one of the best follows on Twitter. So, Rob, I know we've got one more topic we want to talk about. We want to talk about the MLS Cup final coming up. I'm sorry, not the MLS Cup final. We wanted to talk a little bit more about these European groups. Did you look over the groups? What did you think of some of the groups?
I was looking at some of the groups, actually, and to be fair, that's the thing about qualifying, you know, especially for the Euros. I think now that there's so many positions for this Euro, I think it's like, what, 24 teams out of the possible 55 that are in UEFA, so it's making it much, much easier. But looking at the group, I mean, there isn't one that really stands out, I think. I mean, just a quick glance here real quick, I mean, maybe one group that maybe stands out just a little bit is the Iceland, France, and Turkey group. But other than that, I mean, they kind of maybe look just as straightforward as you can think. I mean, you have Netherlands, Germany in one group. You have Portugal, Ukraine, Serbia in another. England, Czech Republic in another one. Denmark, Switzerland, Republic of Ireland, Croatia, Wales, Slovakia. I mean, yeah, Sweden, Norway, Spain. I mean, they're kind of straightforward to go in from that perspective. But certainly, it's going to be a very, very tough group and a tough qualifying process heading into to the start of Euro 2020.
Definitely, no doubt about it. And there are a couple of tough groups in there, but it looks like some easy paths. I mean, I think Italy's got a little bit of an easy path. I think the Bosnia matches and the Greek matches are always going to be tough. That, you know, that tends to be how it falls. You know, going back to what Matt said, Poland, I think, is a pretty easy group. I'm interested to see how Group F breaks. Spain, Sweden, Norway, Romania, Faroe Islands and Malta. Obviously, the last two not going to do much challenging there. But I think Group F can be a little tricky, and Spain might have to be on their best behavior in that one. And I think, you know, obviously Croatia, Wales, they're going to have a little bit of push from Slovakia, but I think you're going to see one of those three teams. I don't know that Hungary has enough to get through. Group D, Switzerland, Denmark, Republic of Ireland, that one looks like an interesting one. Group C, interesting that the Netherlands, Germany, Northern Ireland, Estonia, Belarus, that the Dutch and the Germans are paired in the same group, where the Dutch relegated the Germans from the Nations League. You know, so we're going to be interested to see that one as well. Portugal, Ukraine, Serbia in Group B. Group A, England, Czech Republic, Bulgaria. I think those kind of fall pretty straightforward. I did have one last question for Matt, and I did message it to him so that we could get his answer on here. I wanted to know, because he brought up the Lazio and Roma, you know, situations, how they were kind of underperforming a little bit. And I wanted to know, between Simone Inzaghi and Eusebio Di Francisco, who he felt was going to be the first coach sacked. I don't know that both of them will survive, and it's kind of sad because both are young, inspiring coaches. You know, for me, I've been an advocate of Di Francisco to be the coach of the national team before they gave the job to Mancini. And his answer was Di Francisco. He feels like Di Francisco will be the first coach sacked. So, you know, and again, thanks for Matt. I know we had some technical difficulties there, and it's always expected with live radio, but I'm really grateful for Matt to come on. And I know, Rob, you and I are planning to get to the city one day to go see a match with him, and hopefully we'll do that right into the new year. So, Rob, we've got some matches this week to keep an eye out on. Would you like to give us the rundown, sir?
Yes, we do. So we have in the Premier League, we have Manchester United against Arsenal Wednesday. We have a few midweek games in some of the leagues. We have Man United, Arsenal Wednesday at 3 p.m. We have Chelsea, Manchester City at Saturday at 12:30 p.m. In Ligue 1, we have Montpellier, Lille, Tuesday 3 p.m. PSG, Montpellier. So we're going to have a double. We're going to giving some love to Montpellier this time around. They play PSG on Saturday at 10 a.m. In the Bundesliga, only on the weekend, we have Dortmund, Schalke, the big derby between both these teams, Saturday at 9:30 a.m. Hertha Berlin against Eintracht Frankfurt, Saturday at 12:30 p.m. In Serie A, we have two big games. We have AC Milan against Torino on Sunday at 2:30 p.m. And then on Friday, a good one for a Friday, Juventus-Inter, Friday at 2:30 p.m. Yeah. In La Liga, we have Atletico Madrid and Alaves, Saturday at 7 a.m. And we have the Catalan Derby between Espanyol and Barcelona, Saturday at 2:45 p.m. We just mentioned the MLS Cup Final. We'll mention it again. Atlanta United, Portland Timbers at Mercedes-Benz. 8 p.m. should be the good one to watch. And, of course, the game of the week, which kind of we've been repeating for the last 2-3 weeks, you know, if it happens, River Plate will take on Boca Juniors Sunday at 2:30 p.m. in Madrid, Spain, to become the champion of the 2018 Copa Libertadores. Not the best way not the best thing to say this 3 weeks in a row, but, oh, God, I hope this game gets played.
Tune in Monday to find out when the next rescheduled date is.
Mm-hmm. So, could be Joe's backyard.
It could be my backyard. Let's get Onnit in here one more time. Onnit is a health and fitness juggernaut dedicated to delivering total human optimization to its vast customer base of athletes, thinkers, fitness gurus, and entrepreneurs. Through a wide array of products and supplements, Onnit combines cutting-edge science, earth-grown nutrients, and time-tested strategies to help people reach peak performance. Whether you are climbing mountains or biking down them, building businesses or closing sales, chasing PRs in the weight room, or running a marathon, Onnit is the brand you want in your back pocket. As one of the fastest growing health and fitness companies in the world, Onnit refuses to bring anything but the very best to market. Whether it be energy bars, protein shakes, creatine, or their flagship product, Alpha Brain, Onnit's diverse lineup of products and supplements are backed by science and research. You can save up to 10% off by visiting www.onnit.com and using promo code BEYOND. That is www.onnit.com and using promo code BEYOND to save up to 10%. And thanks to the folks over at Onnit. Rob, you had the trivia question, my friend. Why don't you give it to us again?
Yes, absolutely. So Messi, for the first time since 2007, will not finish into the top three of the Ballon d'Or. He has only finished outside of that two times, in 2006 and 2007. Can you name the rankings?
So I think in 2007 he was third.
Correct.
Okay.
Straight behind Kaká and Cristiano Ronaldo.
And then in 2006, I'm going out on a limb because I'm not 100% positive, but I want to say, because I thought I had heard somewhere that today's fifth place finish was his worst ever in the Ballon d'Or voting. So I'm going to go with he finished fourth in... Was it second then? No, it can't be.
No, right. No, 2006 was his worst because that was his first ever.
Oh, okay. And so he finished fifth. So I'm going to... Let's go... Oh, was it... You know, was it 20th?
Yes, correct. 20th. Wow. He finished 20th in 2006 and finished third in 2007. And since then, for almost a decade, in the top three. Always first or second. And now he finishes fifth. And let's be honest, Joe, he's not the fifth best player in the world.
No. You know, I thought about that. I don't know that he was the fifth best player last year. And I thought about this. I guess we'll spend a few seconds on this. And, you know, he finished... Many people made a big deal about the fact that he finished out of those top voting places. If you remember, there was the awards a couple months ago that Luka Modric won. And, you know, he had a great season last year. I think he led La Liga in goal scoring. He won two titles.
He was
titles.
The top goal scorer in all of Europe.
Yeah, he won the Copa del Rey. They won La Liga and in large part because of him. And I don't know what this negative, you know, maybe it wasn't a Messi-ish year, but I mean, how many goals can you score? When you had Mo Salah scoring 37 goals, you had Mauro Icardi scoring a bunch of goals. You had, I'm trying to think, there was another one that I'm missing right now that scored a boatload of goals.
Ronaldo.
Oh, yeah, Cristiano Ronaldo.
Lewandowski.
Even Lewandowski, exactly.
But 45 goals in 54 games.
Right, exactly. So, I thought back to it. I said, so... They're giving a lot to Modric and deserve that he wins the Ballon d'Or. You know, I think he had an incredible, incredible World Cup. He did it. He won the Champions League. He really did it this year in 2018 on the absolute biggest stages in world football. There's no arguing that. He got Croatia to, you know, obviously with the rest of the team, but they got to the World Cup final. He won the Champions League. There's no doubt about it. My question to you is, well, not that it's a question. My point is that the Ballon d'Or is a vote of the best player for a period of time. Okay, so for 2018, for the most part, everyone feels that Luka Modric was the best player in 2018. And okay, I know we can make the arguments for Kylian Mbappe, and we can make the arguments for Cristiano Ronaldo and Lionel Messi. I get it, and we gave it to Modric, and I think he deserved it. But if you were going to start a football team today, right now, and you could pick any player in the entire world, who would you pick first?
Lionel Messi.
Exactly. So, you know, Luka Modric was the best player this year. Lionel Messi is the best player, period. And that's the difference.
It has been. And well, with certain exceptions with Ronaldo, because he had like a phenomenal year and perhaps was better than Messi in certain seasons. But Messi's been the best player in the world for the last few years.
I would say at least 10.
And so. I mean, come on. Dominating the sport since what? The age of 20, 21, and he's 31 now.
And he's still got years ahead of him. So,
hell yeah.
No absolutely. Doubt about it. So, Rob, nothing else left on the docket here. We gave the matches of the week. Let's hit the closing music.
Let's do it.
All right. So let's get this turned down here a little bit. And so for episode 227 of Low Limit Football, special thanks again to Matt Santangelo for joining us despite all of us having technical difficulties. Next week is our last show of 2018. I can't believe it. We usually take a couple weeks off for the holidays, and we're going to kick that off a little early. So next week will be our last show of 2018. We'll bring you Champions League previews. We'll talk about who's going to be in and who's going to be out. And we'll give you the MLS Cup final champion and maybe the Copa Libertadores final champion if it actually happens. So for episode 227 of Low Limit Football, I am Joe Uccello.
I'm Roberto Rojas.
Thank you for listening, everyone, and good night.